All right, so last week we talked about, well, 2 weeks ago we talked about humility and pride, and this whole, there's kind of a series of lessons going on here that keeps focusing on that same idea here. Last week we talked about strengths and weaknesses. This week we're talking about increasing and decreasing. Go ahead and hit that, Tim. I can't. Okay, there we go. Thank you. So human life, though it doesn't always seem this way, is always dynamic. I know it seems like you go through years where really nothing seems to have changed. Have you ever been that in that point in your life, kind of a stagnant spot? It just seems like everyone and everything just kind of stayed the same. Obviously, that hasn't happened in the last, well, I don't know, 6 months, but certainly you've been through those points. And the fact is, life is ever-changing, it's ever-moving, it's ever-altering. It's not static, it's fluid and in motion all the time. So consider the perpetual, for lack of better words, reallocation of one's status, one's resources, one's values, and then one's behaviors. As you increase in age, you decrease in youth. There's that constant seesaw effect, right? As you increase in wealth, you decrease in poverty. Obviously, that can go the other way too. As you increase in knowledge, you decrease in ignorance. As you increase in popularity, you decrease in anonymity. As you increase in maturity, you decrease in immaturity. As you increase in sophistication, you decrease in simplicity. As you increase in wisdom, you decrease in foolishness. And as you increase in guilt, you decrease in innocence, right? So there is this constant moving, this constant movement that's going on. I call it a reallocation. You can call it whatever you want to here. Some of these effects, of course, are irreversible. Others are fluctuating. One constant is the same in all of them, and that is that the change in one affects a change in the other. And it's kind of like I said earlier, the seesaw effect. As one side increases in height, the other one has to decrease. It cannot be otherwise. Well, unless your seesaw is broken, but that's another story. It just cannot be otherwise, and it's impossible to avoid that effect. As the one side raises, the other one is going to lower. In the spiritual realm, then, we have a very similar dynamic. Godliness and worldliness are on that seesaw. As one increases, the other has to decrease. Whichever one increases, it doesn't matter. The other one has to decrease in response to that. Earthly treasures, or eternal treasures rather, versus worldly goods. As one increases, your value, your focus on earthly treasures increases. Well, then worldly goods certainly decreases as a matter of importance. As Christ increases, self decreases. And we have that song in your songbook, you know, that less of self, more of Christ, or however that is, right? And there's that idea being promoted right there. So as one increases, the other decreases. The increase of the Spirit requires and necessarily implies a decrease in whatever opposes the Spirit. And that goes both ways. An increase in whatever opposes the Spirit decreases the Spirit's influence in your life. It can't be otherwise. It's never going to be otherwise. So there's no union or fellowship or agreement or coexistence between the wickedness of the world and the holiness of God. In other words, they don't come together on a plateau, so to speak, and have that coexist. You've seen those coexist stickers on the bumpers, right? And that's just nonsense. All those competing religions or philosophies and all those things that are expressed in that sticker, it's impossible for those things to literally coexist. As one increases, the others must decrease. So every Christian at any time is either drawing nearer to God or falling away from Him. If you look at it that way, then it makes very much sense why we're talking about this. So as you're either increasing in drawing nearer to God, or you're decreasing as in pulling away from Him. And you're in that position right now, by the way. I don't know where you're at in that seesaw, but I'm telling you that that is happening right now. The principle is summed up in John chapter 3 and verse 30, where John the Baptist said, "He must increase," he meaning Christ, "but I must decrease." A change in one requires a change in the other, because you can't increase in both yourself and Christ at the same time. And neither can you decrease in self and Christ at the same time. But fleshing this out, what does this mean? How is it applied? What benefit to learning? That's the rest of the lesson, okay? All this has just been, well, preview so far. So the proud person says, "Well, look at me. I'm self-sufficient. I'm knowledgeable. I'm wise. I'm rich. I'm independent, I'm resourceful, or maybe even I'm a martyr, I'm a victim, I'm somebody, I'm important. That's what the proud person says. Maybe you said that about yourself at one point in your worldly pride, okay? And that's typical. This is not unnatural. This is kind of the worldly natural expectation. Christ has taught us to look at him in us. So the Christian is taught to say, look at Christ in me. Whatever I have, whatever I know, whatever I have done pales into in comparison to what Christ has done in me. He is important. It's not me that's important. It's him in me that is important. In fact, Christ actually gives us importance. He's the one that truly makes us important. I don't want that to be misconstrued in saying that you're unimportant if you're not a Christian. You're obviously important to God because his son died for you to save you. But the importance of or the value of your life or the meaning of your life becomes exponentially greater now that Christ is there to give meaning to it. Let's look at some verses here that bring this out. Paul says in Romans 15, verse 1, or verse 18, rather, first part, he says, I will not presume to speak of anything except what Christ has accomplished through me. And that is Paul's attitude throughout. I mean, he's constantly deferring to Christ, deferring to Christ. I'll say something about deferment here in a minute. But think about that attitude in ourselves. Or here it says, 1 Corinthians 15:10, by the grace of God, I am what I am. And I'm hoping that that's your attitude. If you're a Christian, I really do hope that that's your attitude. Instead of saying, yes, I've done some great things, you know, like Nebuchadnezzar on the city wall of Babylon. Isn't this Babylon, which I have built with my great might and so on? And things did not go well after that, right? So don't be Nebuchadnezzar, I think is the message there. Or at least don't, you know, have that arrogance about you that says that, look at all the great things I've done. Oh, yeah, and by the way, I'm a Christian. You know, that sort of thing. Look at Christ in you and what he has done for you. Here it sums it up. Galatians 2, verse 20, Paul says, I've been crucified with Christ. He has died with Christ. And that takes us to Romans 6 and so on that talks about when and where that is accomplished. And it is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me. I'm always impressed with the ending of that passage because it makes it extremely personal. Paul isn't saying, and Christ died for us. He says, Christ died for me. Now, that doesn't mean he didn't die for us, but Paul understands that on a very personal level. And so you have to ask yourself, is this you? Is this your attitude? Is this how you think? Is this how you see yourself? Is Christ increasing in you steadily, daily, ongoing, ever-presently? The proud person highlights his own self, his own successes, even his own opinions, his own victimhood. The Christian defers to Christ in all things. That word defer there means literally to yield or show submission in your opinion or judgment, etc., out of courtesy or regard for another. That's kind of a Webster dictionary, but that's what it is. So we're really showing, in showing deferment, we're actually respecting the person that we're deferring to. And we're setting our opinion or our self-worth or whatever it is aside just for a moment so that we can defer to that person. So when we defer to Christ, especially due to his level of authority, sovereignty, and majesty, keep in mind how greatly higher he is than all of us, then we are decreasing ourselves in order for him to increase. And that's really what that deferring is all about. We're choosing. And that's I want to stress that we choose to do this. This isn't something that happens automatically. It's not something that happens to you sitting in a church pew. It's not something that happens to you just because the preacher said so. It's something that happens because you choose it. It's not going to happen otherwise if you don't choose it. So it's something you have to make a conscious, voluntary, even cheerful decision to do. Why? First of all, because Christ deserves that. That makes sense. And secondly, his cause is more important than your own or my own or our own. His cause is more important. And thirdly, we do benefit from doing that. Remember last week's lesson, I said that you're a conduit. Okay? You're the channel, if you will, through whom Christ blesses people or brings about his work or brings about his objectives, and the conduit is always blessed. The conduit always benefits from all of that. All right, so let's go to John the Baptist's response here in John 3:22 through 26. basically, as Phil has already read the passage, so I'm not going to reread all of it. But basically, we have Jesus and his disciples attracting more attention than John the Baptist. And so some people coming up to John saying, hey, Jesus is getting more followers and more attention than you are, John. What do you have to say about that? I mean, what are you going to do about that? It's almost like a challenge there, like a rub, right? This is something you need to take care of. Pride cannot stand to be upstaged, so a proud person's going to think that way. Like, hey, he's doing more and getting more attention than you, and that's not right. The proud person wants to be the center of attention, even if that is negative attention. If you've ever seen a child having a meltdown in the store, you know what I'm talking about. That's negative attention, but they still get it, don't they? Okay, so in order to increase attention on someone other than yourself, that person himself must decrease being self-serving and self-absorbed. And that's the position that John finds himself in. John chapter 3, if you want to read with me there in verse 27 and 28, John answered and said, a man can receive nothing unless it has been given him from heaven. You yourselves are my witnesses that I said, I am not the Christ or the Messiah, but I have been sent ahead of him. So John's basically, as you see on the screen, saying God decides who gets to be glorified or who deserves attention. It's not mine to say that. That's not my thing to do. He defers then to the authority and the prerogative of God himself. God dispenses ministries as he chooses. Far be it from me to tell God how to run his business, how to run his kingdom, or how to dispense glory in whatever way he chooses. That's really what John is saying in response to this. What's really interesting about John, I've done whole lessons on John, December of 2018, I did a couple lessons on him here in the recent past, and John is a pretty fascinating character. He never pretended to be more than who he was. He knew that he was the sign and not the substance. He was the herald of the Messiah, but not the Messiah. He's the one back in John 1:29 who points out Jesus and says, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. But he also recognizes that he deserves center stage, and he never took it for himself. And that's the kind of man that John is, a very humble man. John chapter 3 and verse 29, he says, he who has the bride is the bridegroom. But the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. So the joy of mine has been made full. The friend of the bridegroom, known to us today as kind of the best man, he has an important and responsible role, but it's not the focus of the wedding, and he's not the focus or the center of attention. This friend takes pleasure in serving, and he takes pleasure in fulfilling his role and his function, but he doesn't stand in the way, push the groom out of the way of the picture taking or something like that, and shoves the bride and groom out of the way and says, here I am, I'm the bride, the best man here, I'm the friend of the bridegroom. I mean, he doesn't do that. Well, he shouldn't do that anyway. So the idea there being that he defers, he gives glory, whatever glory might have gone his way, he defers that to the man who deserves it at the moment. And that's what John was doing here. He decreases so that the other can increase. And similarly, we ought to take pleasure in whom we serve. We should not make comparisons between us and say who is better, who is more attention, who is more talented, who is more gifted, who is stronger, if indeed all of us are serving the Lord. This is not a matter of pride. This is a matter of servitude. And so there's no challenge here. There's no challenging here. This is not a competition. I know we've all been in situations, even in churches, where there has been competition and it never goes very well, does it? Because it's not supposed to be that way. We're supposed to be humble servants. And the parallel to us is that you and I ought not to upstage the work of Christ for our own agenda. Your needs, of course, are important. No one's saying otherwise. But they're not more important than the work of the kingdom. They're not more important than the gospel message. And they're not more important than the needs of the entire group. That's where your needs to step aside, decrease, in order for these other things, Christ particularly, to increase. Now, I'm not saying this to any particular event or person. I'm just saying it as a matter of this is where we need to be in our thinking. So that when those opportunities come up, we actually do what we were just taught here instead of going in some other direction. Remember, it is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. This can't be just something that we quote, that we know well, that we sing in songs, or that we plaster on a wall as far as a scripture reading. It's not something we just fit into sermons. It's meant to be a principle of life worship, something that governs the heart and conditions the mind and improves the soul. And yet, that is impossible. All that is impossible to do if you're constantly putting your own personal issues above and over the top of the ministry of Christ and his church. And I want to clarify here, we are speaking broadly and over time. I put here, sometimes life punches us in the face, right? And I think you all know what I mean by that, because you've all probably experienced that one way or the other. And I know I've experienced that here lately, not just with all the shutdown stuff. I lost my father a month ago and did not see that coming, not in the way that it did. And I know some of you have lost loved ones even very recently. In fact, even yesterday, Jamie just lost her grandfather. I know Patsy lost her sister. I know Renata's recently lost her father. I know Beth and Becky have lost a sister and a mother. I mean, these are painful losses. Sometimes life just punches you in the face. And I'm saying that not to give myself or just them any kind of dismissal or excuse or exemption in any way. But I am saying that, you know, we can be going, as we think, full bore for the Lord and doing all these things, and life comes along from the sidelines and just, boom, you know, just does that sort of thing to us. And we don't see those things coming. So, and that does send us reeling. It really does. I guess what I'm saying here in essence is sometimes life forces us to deal with personal, marital, and family issues more than usual, taking us away from you know, our complete focus on the kingdom. Again, I'm not giving you anyone a crutch, myself included. I'm just saying this is reality, all right? So what do? Well, we deal with those issues. We bounce back, and we come back, and we get back in the game. We get back in the stream of things there. The fact is, and this doesn't go away, he must increase, but I must decrease. And that all sounds noble and good, but it is not easy to implement, and it's not easy to practice, and yet that sums up most of our discipleship to Christ, if not all of it. I mean, that, in other words, that is always there in the background, always there like a machine going on in the background. It's always there. We're not supposed to promote our will, but rather to deny ourselves. And that's a difficult concept. Easy to understand, I think, up front. Many think they know what it means, what it looks like, how to achieve. I'm not convinced that that is true. I'll throw myself in that lot. I have struggled with this thing myself over the years. And we're not talking about just denial of something you don't already like. For example, I was thinking when I was writing this lesson, you know, if self-denial was all about denying myself, say, beats, or country western music, this would be easy for me, okay? Because I already hate those two things. So there's no big sacrifice, no big effort there. But that's not what I'm being asked to deny. What I'm being asked to deny is my pride. And what does my pride want? The things I want the most. And there is the rub, right? Our pride is not passive about attention and recognition being given elsewhere, because it craves attention and it demands it to be satisfied, and it insists on being heard, and thus we do not let go of pride easily. And yet Jesus, in his statement there in Matthew 16:24, rather, what is the first thing that he says? Deny your pride. And that's where a lot of people go wrong, right there. We don't know how to deny our pride, or we haven't investigated how, or we just don't want to. And yet that's the first thing he asked for. We just can't afford to reflect the very self-absorbed attitude of our secular society. We cannot be willing to deny pleasures and creature comforts and unwilling, rather, to deny creature comforts and so on, and then say that we're denying ourselves. Sometimes we have to give up those creature comforts. We cannot expect the benefit of discipleship while refusing to pay the cost of discipleship. So it's just, there's always this thing, again, going on in the background of everything that we're doing that's forcing us to constantly address this thing that nobody really wants to address. That means that we have to relinquish our will in order that God's will may be accomplished in us instead. Because Jesus told us that the only ones that are going to enter into the kingdom in the hereafter are those who do the will of the Father, not push our own will through. All right, so here's the conflict. As we had said earlier, there's a war between serving self and serving Christ. There is this constant battle, an unseen battle, Peter calls it, there in 1 Peter 2:11, which is not in your notes, but if you want to write it down, there it is. There's an unseen battle going on. And these things work in proportion to one another. What I mean by that is as the one side of the battle increases, or I should say succeeds, the other side necessarily decreases, because you can't serve two masters equally, and you can't fight a battle where both sides are winning equally. So something has to win, something has to be to lose, or something has to be winning, and the other side has to be losing. He must increase so that I will decrease, and I must decrease so that he will increase. His way, his life, his truth in me must be the increase. My will is the decrease. That's how we have to be thinking as Christians. And the Christian in whom Christ increases, that person decreases in worldly pride and arrogance and ambition. And the decrease is not just, well, it was less than it used to be, or seeking less than it is now, but rather seeking it to be eradicated altogether. I had a verse earlier in the lesson that I didn't put in the notes ultimately, but Romans chapter 8, there in verse 12 and 13, it talks about that very thing. It talks about, when you put to death the deeds of the flesh in order to follow the Spirit. Well, if you're not doing that, if you're not putting to death those deeds of the flesh, then you're not following the Spirit. So the deeds of the flesh are increasing and the spiritual influence is decreasing. So there's something that has to be done, and it's urgent that it be done. And anyone is fooling himself who says that they're who's not actually doing that, but then says that they are a faithful Christian. Because that's how we all want to be, right? We all want to be regarded as a faithful Christian. All right, maybe you are, but maybe you're not. What determines that? It's not just what church building you happen to be sitting in, or what song you're singing, or what preacher you're hearing. Most of this has to do with what God you're listening to, right? It has to do with what God or what Lord or what Master you're giving allegiance to, because that's where it always starts. So there has to be evidence to support the claim. The claim is good if the evidence is good, but if you're habitually indulging in a lifestyle of an unbeliever, then the claim is no good. The claim is just that. It's just a claim, but not a truth. James chapter 4, verse 4, we're told, you adulteresses, and I always find that fascinating, that James is not talking to people out in the world, he's talking to Christians. And he says, you adulteresses, do you not know that a friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. You can't be a friend of God if you're maintaining with friendship with the world. As one increases, the other has to decrease. So if friendship with God is increasing, then friendship with the world has to decrease. But if your friendship with the world is increasing, well, then you're decreasing in your friendship with God. You see what we're talking about? James chapter 4, verse 7 and 8, submit therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Put away the one in order to pursue the other, because you can't go in two opposite directions at once. You can't run north and south at the same time. You can't draw near to God and feed the carnal appetite at the same time. I speak from experience, it doesn't work. Some things in our lives should be destroyed and not replaced. Some associations need to be terminated and not renewed. Some practices need to be discontinued and not restarted. And some long-held beliefs need to be abandoned and be replaced entirely with something far better in their place. I mean, this is the core of the lesson right here. This is where the rubber meets the road, and we separate the men from the boys and all those other idioms and cliches I can't think of right now. But you can fill in the blank there. You understand what I'm talking about. This is the practical application of what we've been saying so far. If you want godliness to flourish, worldliness in you has to be removed, because these can't walk side by side. When you try to do that, you create what's called an unholy union, a union that didn't come from God, that God did not authorize, and that God will not recognize as being valid. It will be your destruction. And certainly God doesn't want that of you. You cannot affect the one side without affecting directly the other. I'd like you to see this from an increase-decrease point of view and from the Beatitudes there in Matthew chapter 5, verse 1 through 12. In other words, to be poor in spirit, you can't be rich with pride and self-reliance. We're told in 1 Timothy 6, 18, that let the rich be rich with good works, not focus on their money. Okay. So what has to happen? Well, there has to be an increase in the right things. Poor in spirit means humility. It's what we've been talking about. To be mournful or to mourn, you can't seek pleasure and satisfaction in self-gratitude or self-gratification, rather. You have to hate sin. And I know that's a tough thing sometimes, because I really believe that sometimes Christians struggle with sin, not because it's so horrible in their minds, but because they actually like it so much. They gravitate toward it. They crave it. And we're told to hate it. To be gentle, you can't be one of those who belittles and tears down, treat people as expendable just so that you look better. Jesus, our Savior, never did those things. To hunger and thirst after righteousness, you can't crave and long for the worldly treasures and material wealth and temporary joys. So there has to be a shift here. If I'm going to increase in hungering and thirsting for righteousness, my hunger and thirsting for this world has to decrease. It has to decrease, because I can't do both of these at the same time. In order to be merciful, we can't have pleasure in gossiping and judging and condemning others. We're told in James 2, verse 13, for example, that mercy is greater or superior to judgment. To be pure in heart, we can't fill our heart with sinful lusts and hatred and resentment and bitterness, because we're told in James chapter 1 and verse 20 that the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. So you have to choose one or the other. One has to increase so that the other can decrease, or one has to be decreased so that the other can increase. To be a peacemaker, you have to let go of strife and contention and grudges, because quite honestly, they're not worth losing your soul over. And to be persecuted for the sake of righteousness, not just persecuted, but for a particular reason in God's sight, you must not suffer the consequences of wrongdoing. 1 Peter 2, verse 20 says, what credit is there if you suffer for things you did wrong? There's no credit there. Jesus isn't talking about you just going to jail because you stole the neighbor's chickens or something like that. He's talking about you enduring under pressure from someone else, you enduring harsh treatment at the hands of someone who is imposing or oppressing you. And you're doing it for the sake of God. The point here is that if you want Christ to increase, you have to voluntarily and actively choose to decrease, because he's not going to force the issue. He's not going to press the issue. He's laid it out. He's told you what needs to be done. The instructions are there. You're an intelligent person. You can read this. You can figure this out. It's really not that difficult, at least in the instruction. Once again, human life is dynamic. It's ever-changing. It's ever-adjusting. As one aspect increases, another decreases, and vice versa. And the spiritual life, as we said, is the same way. If one is increasing in pride and worldliness, well, then his fitness as a servant of God decreases, and vice versa. If his fitness in Christ increases, well, then his influence, the world's influence upon him will decrease. But this never evens out. It never stands still. If one is not increasing, then he is decreasing. The seesaw principle never rests. John the Baptist understood this. In fact, he taught this as a divine principle of spiritual growth. He lived by it himself, and I would say that he even died for it. And the reason why some Christians fail to become spiritually mature is not because the instruction is so hard, and it's not because of preachers, although they'll blame them, and it's not because of shepherds, although they get blamed. It's not because churches didn't do everything for me that, you know, I expected, although those will get blamed too. You know, it's not always out there. It's right in here. It's in ourselves. Why they don't become spiritually mature is because they're not paying attention to this very basic increasing and decreasing concept. To pursue excellence, you have to give up the bare minimum approach. What I'm referring to there is I'll do just the bare minimum to get by, but don't ask anything else of me. To pursue excellence, you have to walk the narrow path that leads to life, which means you have to quit doing the path of least resistance, which is so common to human nature and so prevalent among people. To pursue excellence, you have to learn to be a servant of Christ and be a servant of those who belong to Christ, which means, nobody wants to hear this, but here it is, you have to quit putting your family and your friends and even yourself above Christ and his people. On the other hand, the more we increase in Christ, the less appealing worldliness and pride appears to us. And we cultivate a new and better hunger than that for the world. We hunger now no longer for worldliness and secular pleasures and temporary joys. We look for something much bigger and better than that. Now we have a hunger and a thirst for righteousness. And in heaven, should we all get there, and that is my strong hope, in heaven, Christ will forever be present and pride will forever be gone. The seesaw will not only rest at that point, it will be taken out of the equation altogether. Because then we will have arrived. But the heavenly attitude doesn't start in heaven. The heavenly attitude starts right here and now. Right here, even today. So the point of preaching the gospel is not to push people away. The point of preaching the gospel, ideally, is to speak directly to what needs to be done. And it's not to satisfy my or this congregation's expectations, but rather to enter into fellowship with God and to remain in that fellowship for the rest of our lives and even into the eternity to come. I hope that what we have said this morning is to that objective, and I hope that you have received it in that way. That was the intention. The lesson is now yours. If there is anyone that does need to respond by coming forward, maybe you're ready to be baptized into Christ. Maybe you're ready to confess sin. Maybe you're ready to just recommit your life. Maybe you just want to have people pray for you specifically. We're here to help you out. If we can do that for you this morning, you can come forward as we stand and sing the song Richard has selected for us here.